on the 21st, we're talking immigration, migrant workers, and your family stories of why they came to this country. InvestigateMidwest.org has revealed terrible living conditions in a migrant worker housing facility in central Illinois. We'll bring you the details. We'll also speak with the mayor of Gary, Indiana, about that city council's unanimous vote to reject building an $80 million immigrant detention facility. In our Redream project, we talk about family migration stories. And have you seen this video yet?
Science is constantly producing new studies, as you would know if you've ever watched TV.
A new study shows how sugar might fuel the growth of cancer. A new study suggests hugging your dog is bad for your dog.
We're talking with Joanne Manister, a.k.a. the Science Goddess, about John Oliver's takedown of scientific studies and how we in the media cover them. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Study after study tells us lots of information about wine, coffee, exercise, pregnancy. We are often bombarded with what's good and what isn't, and we know we in the media do not exactly help the situation. On the most recent Last Week Tonight on HBO, John Oliver tackled this subject. That video on YouTube has been going viral. If you haven't seen it, it's got almost 3 million views in the past 3 days. And in case you haven't had a chance to listen to the 20-minute segment, here's a little sampling of it for you.
Science is constantly producing new studies, as you would know if you've ever watched TV.
A new study shows how sugar might fuel the growth of cancer. A new study suggests hugging your dog is bad for your dog.
Time.com once even ran the headline, "Scientists say smelling farts might prevent cancer." Remember that Time story about farts and cancer? It turns out the study never mentioned either of those things. Or the news said our baby is made of chocolate and it's okay if I eat it, but only two-thirds.
Today, we're joined in studio by Joanne Manister. She's a faculty lecturer in biology at the University of Illinois and a science communicator who goes by the handle Science Goddess on Twitter. She's here to help us sort all of this out. Joanne, welcome to the 21st. It's great to have you here.
Well, great. Thank you for having me on today.
And I think John Oliver does make a really good point about all of the flashy headlines about science studies. And he talks about how they tend to contradict each other, right?
They do.
And so I think a lot of people can relate to this feeling of one day coffee's good for you, the next day coffee's killing you. I think there's a very basic question here, which is how can you trust what scientists are saying if it seems like science is always contradicting itself, or at least scientists are changing their minds?
Yeah, well, it seems like scientists are changing their minds, but really what's happening is scientists are studying different aspects of similar topics. And this is how we get a fuller picture, a bigger picture of how the world really works. And we eventually come to a point where something makes sense, that patterns emerge. And then we can really say, yes, this is what's happening. And of course, when it comes to biology, things are very variable. And so it is harder to pin down. Exactly. This happens all the time, no matter what.
Right. And I think maybe the problem, which is to take a step back, which is what we're hoping we can do with this conversation, is take a step back and look at this issue. By the way, if you want to comment, you can tweet to us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. You can call us 1-800-222-9455. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Even if you just want to vent about a scientific study that you followed for a long time that maybe you thought was not a great one. And now you're frustrated because after 2 years of, like, I think especially with diets, right? Because there's always all of this. But let's play. I think that there's one. The segment is really funny in the sense of that it makes sense of the kind of sensationalized health and science news coverage you see out there. Hopefully not on our airwaves. But I think he does raise some really important points about a serious point about the pressure scientists face to publish results because papers lead to more funding and to tenure. And I wanted to play a little clip of John Oliver talking about the science behind the publishing, a little bit more about this issue.
To get those results, there are all sorts of ways that, consciously or not, you can tweak your study. You could alter how long it lasts, or make your random sample too small to be reliable, or engage in something that scientists call p-hacking.
Is that a thing? What is p-hacking?
That is getting your proper sample size, you know, and getting it to work together. And of course, he veers off and makes
right.
up a new word, of course.
Yeah, that we couldn't play on public radio airwaves. We did have to be very careful about editing all of this. We have the whole video up on Facebook. If you would like to listen to it without children around, you're certainly welcome to. You can find our Facebook page. But this notion that scientists, and I wonder how you would respond to this from a scientific perspective, that scientists can play with their data and find something that looks like an important result but really isn't.
Yes. Well, most scientists work very hard to be true to the statistics, but statistics can lie. Statistics can be manipulated. And sometimes in the rush to publish something, there might be some tweaking going on.
But would you? How often would you say that you think that happens frequently? There's certainly a whole peer review process that happens with science. I mean, would you say that John Oliver is totally off base with what he's saying?
No, I don't think he's totally off base, but I certainly don't have a number, and I don't want to say one out
right.
loud and find out I'm wrong. And so find out on Twitter. Everyone will tell me what percent. Actually, if you're following me on Twitter at Science Goddess, and you know what percent is actually.
Oh, that's a good point. You can tweet to us. Tweet to Joanne or tweet to us to 21st Show.
Yes, yes. What percentage of scientists are probably actually tweaking their data significantly? And we do know that some do, or something was inadvertently published and it has to be retracted. And that is a formal process where, you know, even after peer review, maybe something was published, the journal will then, you know, review after some time, after enough people comment and say, you know, maybe this wasn't such a good study. So we are going to officially retract that paper. And there are some famous papers that have been retracted.
What are the most famous instances that you can think of?
The most famous instance I can think of that was the study by the doctor in the UK who said that MMR vaccines cause autism. Mm. This is the most famous retracted paper. And so then they found, as they did, other scientists did further studies, that really his study was poorly done. He had a small sample size and the statistics weren't well done. So his paper was pretty much invalid. So they retracted it. Unfortunately, you know, for the case of vaccines, the damage has been done.
Well, and as a scientist, do you get frustrated at media coverage of this issue because everybody will sort of jump on the one headline, and then if there is a retraction or a more thorough debate that happens, I'm going to guess that doesn't get as much coverage. I think it has in the case of immunizations and vaccines, because certainly that's been something that's been debated and covered for years at this point. But I wonder about other studies that maybe don't get as much coverage.
Right. So, yeah. Oh, of course, I get frustrated. So scientists get frustrated and journalists get frustrated, especially when they perceive that, you know, someone has taken the material and sensationalized it. Or John Oliver, of course, talks a lot about the morning TV talk shows where, you know, everything is just for viewers to get them peaked.
He has a great clip of that, and it's basically, I think, the media and I think this is his point about scientific studies being preliminary, but if it's catchy, I think obviously, especially morning media, especially if it's something about chocolate or pregnancy.
Turns out if you're pregnant, eating 30 grams a day of chocolate, that's about two-thirds of a chocolate bar, not the whole chocolate bar, could improve blood flow to the placenta and benefit the growth and development of your baby, especially in women at risk for preeclampsia or high blood pressure in pregnancy.
Except that's not what the study said. It's like a game of telephone. The substance gets distorted at every step.
So instead of asking if there's a problem with the way media reports on scientific studies, I thought I'd ask you, how would you like to see studies get reported on in the media? What information do you think has to be in there if someone's covering something about a study?
Right. This is where it gets tricky, because there's always the balance between entertainment and catching people's eyes and portraying science as it really is done. And so what they do need to have in the study, or, you know, in the reporting of the study is, you know, what was the sample size? You know, oh, this was done with 20 women and then there was no control. Well, okay, that's not very good. But then again, we need to ask, does the audience even care? You know, so this is a problem where, you know, scientists would rather it be qualified. You know, this is how many people we studied it on. Here's what we were really looking for. And this was it. Now our conclusion either matches what we thought we would find or not. But now it's just, it's come down to, oh, you know, we do want this to be relevant to people's lives. But in the quest to do that, sometimes they forget what were the scientists actually looking for.
Right. And so we always need to know the sample size, I guess, is...
Was there a control or not?
Right. Yeah. And then would you also want to know, is that the main thing? And I guess, would you also assume that everything that's in a journal is peer reviewed, or would it be, or would there, are there journals that just have, and I think when people think, I think people also as news consumers are, if you hear like the Journal of Pediatrics, like yesterday we talked about the Journal of Pediatrics had a study, had information about calls that were made to poison control centers about children with e-cigarettes with liquid nicotine. And I'm sort of like, okay, it's in the Journal of Pediatrics. We feel like that's probably a pretty legitimate publication. Would you assume that most journals are peer reviewed?
Most of them are. There are some that are not, and actually you could just pay to publish, but they don't have the same impact.
You can just pay them? So you just say,
yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but that's rare, and that's sort of shady. A legitimate scientist would not want to publish there, but if they thought, well, let me just get this published somewhere, they could do that. There is also the open science movement, but that is also peer-reviewed.
And when we say peer-reviewed, for someone like me who's not a scientist, what does that mean, peer-reviewed?
That means you have other scientists who are in your field.
But how
reading
many?
Your work.
Does it have to be more than two, or
yeah,
is there
I
a sort
probably,
of a number?
Probably 3 to 5, but it depends on the field and the topic you are studying, and you know where is most of the money going to these days? I think that influences how many peers will review it. But the journal assigns the peers, so when you submit a paper, let's say to Nature, your paper will be sent to a certain number of other scientists to take a look at, and they will send back some information. What, you know, correct this, maybe redo this, reword this, and sometimes they outright reject it if they think it's not a good enough study. And then you will try maybe with a slightly lower impact journal.
We're speaking to Joanne Manister. She goes by the handle Science Goddess on Twitter. She teaches. She's a faculty lecturer in biology at the University of Illinois. And we're having this conversation because of John Oliver's takedown of not just scientific studies, but how the media covers them. That's a video that's gone viral. Lots of people in the science community have been talking about it. So we thought it would be a great conversation for the 21st. And Joanne, you said something about funding in terms of people maybe want to peer review something if the funding's there. And I wonder if you could explain that a little bit more in terms of, are there certain topics that are just maybe kind of, for lack of a better term, sexier and get more funding and then lots more people are interested in it?
Well, I think there are certainly items that are more relevant and more timely in the science community. That's more important than necessarily what's sexy, but sometimes they also happen to be sexy. So right now, one of the hot things is, can we edit the genome? Can we edit DNA cheaply and efficiently? And there's this new molecule called CRISPR, and it's a method to cut DNA. Well, that gets a lot of press, but it's also getting a lot of funding because we want to see what are the possibilities with this new tool.
And does it matter how much press a study gets in terms of funding?
Not necessarily. It's not inconsequential. You know, if you get a lot of notice, that could be helpful. But really, when it comes down to funding, it's the scientists who will know better.
I wonder if we could get a little meta here, because we had a Facebook comment from someone who was complaining that John Oliver cherry-picked the worst examples of media coverage in his segment criticizing scientists for doing basically the same thing. But do you think John Oliver was essentially being unfair of how both scientific studies are done and how the media covers them?
Well, I don't think he's unfair about how media covers. Now, there are better places to get a more serious coverage of a science story. So proper science journalists and writers, let's say at the Washington Post or the New York Times, or, you know, more respected publications rather than your Good Morning America type shows, you're going to get better coverage and more clear-eyed analysis of the paper.
I know this morning you shared the segment with your 56,000 followers on Twitter, and I wonder what kind of response you've been hearing, especially from the scientific community, because this is, I think it's interesting your perspective as a science communicator as well.
Right. So I shared it yesterday morning. I saw it at 6 a.m. I know it aired Sunday night, and people were mostly liking and sharing and retweeting and things like that, but not a lot of comments, but mostly because they know John Oliver's actually going to give us a good idea of how science communication is going wrong. And John Oliver and Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert all have this reputation for actually being fans of science, mm-hmm. and good at sharing this with the public. I think people get more science from these satirists than they do, you know, maybe from, you know, the people who may never pick up the New York Times.
Well,
and
I guess you can make the same argument about news also, that they're also doing
right.
a lot more
right.
news and science than, especially for us, I think, for specific audiences too.
Exactly.
Well, what do you think that scientists can learn from them about how they communicate information?
Oh, that's really good. Yes. Yeah, so, well, I guess, you know, we can't expect every scientist to become, you know, hilarious and a satirist
and pithy.
Witty and pithy. Exactly. Right. We can't expect that. And I don't want that. And, you know, I do actually, I found myself, at the end of the segment, if you watch it, there's the Todd Talks where he's making fun of TED Talks. And my favorite person was actually the scientist, the actor who was playing a scientist. And I was like, wow, I'm really into science. You know, I found him more entertaining than everybody else. But he showed everybody bored and asleep when the scientist was talking. It was pretty funny.
Well, different audiences for different people, right?
That's right.
That's Joanne Manister. She's goes under the Twitter handle Science Goddess. She's a faculty lecturer in biology at the University of Illinois. Joanne, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I was happy to be here.
Up next on the 21st, stories about immigration, migration, and the American dream. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The American dream. White picket fences. 2.78 kids and a dog. It's a dream we once shared. What is success to you? What dreams do you chase?
To work a job that's going to make a difference in somebody else's life.
For many, higher education means social mobility.
People can come from anywhere, and if you're willing to work hard enough, you can have it all.
But there are still people that are left behind for a lot of different reasons. There's room, a lot of room for improvement across the board.
On the 21st, we've been taking part in a national project called ReDream, Imagining the American Dream. Those are some of the stories that we've been talking about. And we've had conversations about how that dream has changed, how dreamers and undocumented students are advocating for themselves here in Illinois. Today, we wanted to take some time to share family stories of immigration, whether that's you, your parents, or maybe your great-grandparents. On Saturday, we're having an event we're hosting in collaboration with the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul. It's all about the American Dream Reimagined. We wanted to invite you to this event. Everyone's welcome. We'll be talking about family stories. It's free. It's at noon. It's at the Multicultural Center in Rantoul. All are welcome. We've got the information on our Facebook page. If you search for the 21st on Facebook, if you follow our Twitter handle, that's 21stshow, we'll tweet out all of the information and all be on our website as well, which is 21stshow.org. Joining us in studio to give us a preview are two of the people I'll be speaking more with on Saturday. Martha Gonzalez is the executive director of the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul, and Anka Voss is the director of archives and special collections at the Champaign County Historical Archives at the Urbana Free Library. Martha, Anka, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for having me.
Martha, for those people who've never been to Rantoul, can you tell everybody where it is and what it's like?
Okay, Rantoul is very close to Champaign, 20 minutes away from Champaign. It's not that far away. And my experience with Rantoul has been like, from 10 years ago, I started helping families who come to work in agriculture in the area. So I was volunteering for the Migrant and Seasonal Head Start program. And I'm sorry about my voice. I've been
You've had a little bit of a cold. That's okay.
Yes. So I've been helping them since then, trying to meet their needs. When they arrived here to work in agriculture, they didn't have a lot of things.
A lot of resources.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we were trying to help them. And in Rantoul, they live in Rantoul because there is a special, you know, Rantoul was Air Force Base.
Yeah, the Chanute Air Force Base was there originally. And I wanted to get into the history of that. And Anka, I wonder, from your perspective, mm-hmm. as a historian, I think people who aren't in the Champaign-Urbana area may not be familiar with that Air Force Base.
Sure.
But that was actually established in the early 1900s, right?
Well, it was established in 1917 to support the armed forces efforts during World War I. But the base was around, of course, for decades and supported the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and beyond.
In fact, the Tuskegee Airmen even trained there originally.
Right, for less than a year, but yes, that was an important piece of history for Chanute. Mm-hmm. But I think what's really important about the history of Chanute and its impact on the community is, you know, the population waxed and waned based on the war effort that the U.S. was in. But overall, the Chanute Air Force Base or Chanute Airfield trained over 2 million men and women over its lifetime. Mm-hmm. And when it closed in 1993, its population has dropped precipitously between 1970 in 2014, I looked at some census data, the population of Rantoul dropped by 48%.
Right.
In 1970, there were over 25,000 people living in Rantoul. In 2014, it was a little over 13,000. So a big impact.
A big impact. That's Anka Voss. She's the Director of Archives and Special Collections at the Champaign County Historical Archives. Martha Gonzalez is in studio with us as well, because we're talking about stories, sort of history and present of communities across Illinois, and we're focusing on Rantoul in part because of the event that we're doing there, talking about people's family stories of why their families came to this country. And I'm going to get to that with you two in a minute. But as we're talking about that demographic shift, Martha, I wonder how the community in Rantoul has changed since the base closed in the 90s. You said you've been here for 10 years. Is that when we started to see the shift of a much bigger Hispanic population in the area?
I've been living in the United States for 21 years, but my experiences with Rantoul started like probably for 10, 15 years. But yeah, that the population has shifted, especially during the summer. As she says, that the population dropped. So there were all of these empty buildings. One of them was the old hospital, the building that used to be a hospital. So the new owner bought it, and he did some renovations to accommodate it to a housing for migrant families.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it's currently using for.
So according to data from the Census Bureau, the number of Hispanics living in the Rantoul area has actually increased 262% over the past decade. And is all of that because of the agricultural work?
It's mainly of the agricultural work. What happened is these families come to work in agriculture. They have the campus, the camp there, the migrant camp. And another, it's affordable housing around Rantoul. And they find the support in our, one of the supports they find is in our center. We support, provide all the resources. So families don't want to change. They travel all.
So they're there year round, is what you're saying?
They're coming from Texas, some of them from Mexico, some of them from Florida. So they decide to stay here after they see that they have a settled house. They find these resources, so they decide to year after year. What I'm seeing through the years is that every year it's increasing the population because they don't want to move anymore. From here, they come from there to do work in corn here, the tasseling corn, and then they go to another state to do another field.
So they're tasseling corn here, but then this is the base for the area.
Yeah, and then they go to another state to do strawberries, to another state to do tomatoes, another state to do asparagus. But with the whole family, children, transitioning children everywhere is very difficult for a family. So they found here in Rantoul, and Rantoul officials have been very supportive of these families, so they decide to find to stay and find the jobs in another.
How did the community, the multicultural community center in Rantoul, come about, Martha?
We started in 2008. I saw the need because it was huge need. This was we started with the migrant and seasonal head start program.
And what, and a need specifically for what? For
need for childcare.
For childcare.
For childcare for children 0 to 5. So we started with the Mayan Hispanic Head Start program, and then the community themselves said, please don't close. We're running the program only during the summer from July through October. And then the families requested, please keep it open year round. We really need the services. So we decided to keep it open. Now it's year-round to the whole community. Mm. We don't focus only on the migrant families anymore. We focus on the whole community.
That's Martha Gonzalez. She's executive director of the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul. In studio with us as well as Anka Voss, a historian. And Anka, as we're hearing Martha's story about the families that maybe didn't intend to stay but have stayed, I wanted to ask you about your family's story, because I understand when you came to the U.S. from Germany when you were 13, it wasn't necessarily your plan or intention to stay.
No, it was not my plan.
Or your family's, yes. I would imagine. Because at 13, I'm not sure you were making those decisions.
Yeah,
right?
I wasn't making those decisions. When I came with my stepfather and my mother. My stepfather was working for the German government and on a consulting job for a year in the Boston area, which was only supposed to last a year. And the contract got extended and extended. So, you know, initially, we only made plans, you know, for that year, but then I started having to make plans. So I finished high school, and then I started college. And then by the time my stepfather and my mom returned to Germany, I had started graduate school. And at that point, I envisioned my future here in the United States much more than I could returning. Although it was a very hard choice, even today, my father still lives in Germany, and so does my extended family. But it was, I guess a dream that built over time, and the opportunities that I saw, especially in my field, that I thought would give me a future here. So I'm very grateful for all that.
That's Anka Voss, and I asked her to tell that story specifically because on Saturday at our event, which will be at the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul, we're going to ask everybody to share their stories of why their family came to the U.S. And again, it's part of this project we've been doing with ReDream, which is a national project we're taking part in to have conversations about this. And there's different stories that we've been sharing with you throughout the past couple of weeks. And this is the ReDream project. I wanted to play another story from one of the folks who participated. His name is Rory O'Connor.
The American dream is simply the ability to achieve what you set out for. It's not like, say, Middle Eastern countries or Russia or China, where, you know, you read about all of the graft and corruption that goes on there. I think in America, if you have the talent and if you have the desire, you can actually have the freedom to go do whatever you want. You also have the freedom to fail. There are so many things that go into anybody who's been successful. I think it's not been afraid to go after new things or different things. And to be heavily involved in the community, it's number one, been happy with where you are, having watching your kids grow up if you're lucky enough to have kids, helping them achieve whatever they want to achieve, and absolutely living within whatever means that you have. I think it's fairly simple. I would actually love to have a sit-down discussion with somebody who thinks that they're locked out of the American dream and try and guide them through a process that would show them that they're not.
That's Rory O'Connor's story, and it's from the ReDream Project. The 21st has been partnering with ReDream. That's a production of Kansas City Public Television, KCPT. When we're talking about how the American dream has been reimagined and sharing those stories. In studio with me, Anka Voss, she's a historian. She was just sharing her family story of how she came from Germany. Also in studio with us, Martha Gonzalez. She's executive director of the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul, where we're having our event on Saturday. Martha, what brought you to the United States? United States?
Well, my dream.
And what was your dream?
Since I was little, my dream was to learn English. And I got a job at the Central Bank of Colombia. And one of the requirements was to speak the language because I had to travel. So I really wanted to do it. I studied classes in Colombia, but it didn't work that much. So English classes came to me. So that's why I came to the United States to learn English.
To learn English.
Yes.
And when was that? 20 years ago.
Okay. Yes. 20 okay. years. So I came and studied English, and then I really saw in the United States the country of opportunities. Honestly, when I started in college, I saw that it was no excuses to not go to school. They have all the opportunities. They have loans. They have the support. They have the advisors. They have everything here, which at my country we didn't have at that time, all of those resources. So that was a dream to me. That was, oh, my goodness, we have it all here. Jobs were available, any jobs, and they valued my job. So I started working here, and they saw the
potential. What did you do?
I started at restaurants, I started babysitting, I started cleaning houses, I started doing I started doing what I could. And then I was offered a job at the Regional Planning Commission when I started working with the families. And I started helping, at that time there were not many people who speak Spanish. So they were calling me and, please help me with this, please help me with that. And I saw a huge need. And I couldn't say no. They were knocking at my door at 1 a.m., calling me on my phone and at home. And I couldn't say no. I have to help, and I have to support them. Since then, I've been doing it.
So that became a new dream for
yes,
you.
Yes, that was my dream. Yeah. Actually, I have a dream when I was little that I probably was 15 years old. One day, I have to have a big company who can provide jobs for everybody, and I want to help everybody. So I'm helping in another regards, but I'm helping people. That was my dream, helping others.
That's Martha Gonzalez. Anca Voss, I want to ask you a historical question about when we were thinking about the airbase and how many people went through there. I wonder how many, I imagine a lot of those people were probably also recent immigrants of people who came through the base.
I don't have any specific statistics about that, but certainly a lot of the support personnel, the people that were trained in Rantoul often came temporarily, you know, and lived there for training. But there was a lot of support personnel and, of course, a lot of commercial activity in Rantoul because of the base. Also, the Rantoul, as a result of the base, received a lot of federal dollars for infrastructure improvements. So, again, places where people could work and also how it improved Rantoul. So an important impact.
Martha, when you look at the residents of Rantoul today, are there common themes you notice in terms of the dreams they have for themselves and for their children?
Oh, yes, they are. The families that I work with, they have their own dreams, and as any family, they want to their children be educated and be successful. They have jobs in Rantoul, as you said, they have available jobs in Rantoul. Mm-hmm. So they are, they have the jobs available. They want to grow up economically and educationally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's Martha Gonzalez with the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul. Anca, as you're hearing these stories, I wonder if you think about, as you're thinking about, the whole point of this project is to have conversations about the American dream. And I wonder if you feel like, as a historian, you think that that dream has changed in terms of people coming to the U.S.?
Oh, I'm not sure. I think new immigrants, I think in some sense the dreams are the same.
Mm-hmm.
People are still looking for opportunities. I think they probably are different opportunities and sometimes even more of a refuge than just opportunity. I think there are lots of places around the world that are not a great place to be right now. So
that's Anca Voss. Thanks to her and to Martha Gonzalez. We've got all the information about event on Saturday on our website if you head to 21st Show. Thanks for being with me.
Oh, no, you're welcome.
Thank you.
I just want to say the American dream is very much alive.
Yes.
Thank you for saying that. All right. you're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. By the way, a note from our previous segment, Anka Voss wanted me to mention that the archives actually from the Chinook Air Base are actually on their way to the Urbana Free Library right now. So those are going to be available in the coming year for residents, for people who are interested in those archives. Last week, Gary City Council voted against a plan to build an $80 million immigration detention facility in their town in Indiana. The plan would have brought tax revenue and jobs to the struggling community, but at a very raucous meeting, many residents said that a detention facility would be bad for Gary's image. Council members apparently agreed the vote was 9-0. Joining us on the phone right now to talk about the vote is the mayor of Gary, Indiana, Karen Freeman Wilson. Mayor Freeman Wilson, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
What did this proposal for this immigration detention facility involve?
Well, the proposal involved the ability for the GEO group to apply or respond to an RFP that would have been issued by the federal government to establish an 800-bed detention facility in the city of Gary, in the footprint of the Gary-Chicago International Airport. There were also considerations given to the city of Gary, dollars towards workforce and economic development programs, also an impact fee relative to for the facility that was related to public safety and service support. There was discussions about the provision of a match for the paving of infrastructure in that area, because there had already been dollars allocated from federal programs. And that was, and of course, the fact that they were going to be building a facility without the benefit of any incentives from the city of Gary, so that would have added to the tax revenue for the city.
Right. Mayor Freeman Wilson, was this something that Gary wanted, was inviting having a detention facility possibly built there?
It was something certainly that I initially considered, but ultimately determined that it would not be a good thing. But there were also members of the council who were in fact supportive of it initially, and, you know, thought that the jobs provided, that the economic opportunity that it represented for the city was something that should have been considered. And then there were members of the council who said that we needed to hear them out. And, you know, I certainly understood that position.
That's the mayor of Gary, Indiana, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. And joining us now is the Common Council President of Gary, Ron Brewer. He's with us as well. Ron, it sounds like the mayor and members of the council were thinking about this, but I know that everything changed at the meeting that took place last week. And in reading the news coverage, I get the sense there was a heated discussion at this meeting. What was it like, Ron?
It was a heated discussion. One of our council persons, during a meeting before that, we had a tie vote, and he made a recommendation that we move the meeting to last Tuesday, in which he wanted more time to defer it to the following meeting. That way we can have a community forum on it, and we can discuss the different things that GEO was going to bring to the table. Majority of the council kind of wanted to get it over with, and they didn't want to go through the discussion because they had received calls from people inside the community. And also with the people that was coming to the forum, they just didn't want it.
And what happened at the forum? I understand there was lots of chanting. I know that you tried to have a 30-minute recess, and there was lots of shouting.
Yeah, there was chanting, your average protest that was going on. But basically what the council was, we were just checking out rules. We had two different council persons, a parliamentarian and one of our council at large, had a discussion on the rules that was being used. And we had two books that was being used. Those are the two Robert Rules of Order books. And we had never had this problem before when we had two council people challenging the order of the law.
Okay. And why did you all, President Brewer, why did you all change your minds? I know that as and Mayor Wilson, Mayor Freeman Wilson, I'm going to ask you the same thing in a minute, but Ron Brewer, originally it sounds like there were some people on the council who thought this would be a good idea. Why do you think there ended up being unanimous opposition to building this detention facility in Gary?
Well, I don't know some of the reason why some people that was for it changed their minds on it. But once I saw that we didn't have the votes, there was no sense of trying to string this thing out. So I just voted no myself to go ahead and kill the whole deal.
Why did you initially support it?
Well, my initial support was I wanted to see exactly what they can offer us. I heard about the MOU that was firstly proposed. I saw different changes that could be made inside of that. And GEO was willing to make a lot of different new incentives for the city. A couple of them was I talked to GEO about roofs that we needed for the schools. GEO was willing to go to the table and sit down and negotiate different things. And their sentiment was that they know that they needed us probably more so than we needed GEO. So that's the way they looked at it. They were willing to do quite a bit of different things for us.
Well, and I think that makes sense. And Mayor Freeman Wilson, I wanted to ask you, as Ron Brewer was talking about needing roofs for the schools, I mean, certainly it's tough to think about economic development throughout smaller towns in the Midwest. And I think Gary is no exception to wanting resources and economic development and having a business that comes in. What are your thoughts now, Mayor Freeman Wilson, as this opportunity obviously is no longer available for you all? I mean, do you feel like this was a missed opportunity for you all, or do you just feel like it wasn't worth it because it was an immigrant detention facility?
Well, I certainly don't believe this to be a missed opportunity. I understand the tremendous needs that we have in the community. I think it puts the impetus on us as community leaders to work even harder to cultivate those economic development opportunities that are not controversial, that will allow us to be better partners. My concern was always, separate and apart from the human rights concerns, it was our ability to monitor, GEO as a private entity, and our ability to develop any guidelines for federal related jobs. You know, we want jobs for our community. The council and I agree 100% on that. But you also have to be able to have some influence over who gets those jobs, whether it's a stipulation and a variance or whether it's a separate agreement. And because these are federally qualified jobs, because this is a private entity, I really questioned our ability to have any impact on who got those jobs.
All right. That's Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson of Gary, Indiana. Thanks also to Gary Common Council President Ron Brewer on the unanimous decision late last week to vote against an $80 million immigrant detention facility in their town. Thank you for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier this hour, we were talking about Rantoul and about the changing demographics in that area. Well, you know, a recent report from the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting found that housing at the largest registered migrant worker facility in the state is in bad shape. Mold and pest infestations, phone lines that didn't work, filthy bed covers are among the problems documented in hundreds of inspection reports that journalists Robert Hawley and Claire Everett went through. Robert joins us today to talk about what he found. Robert, thanks for being with us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We were just talking about the massive amounts of people who have moved to the Rantoul area earlier in the hour, and I wanted to ask you about these migrant camps. What are these facilities meant to be for, and who's in charge of them?
Right. So before talking about the facilities themselves, it's important to clarify the population that they're housing. Migrant farm workers in the United States it's a diverse population. You have some migrant farm workers who are legal U.S. residents coming from places like Texas, to work in Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, in the agriculture fields, picking vegetables or fruit, simply because they couldn't get a job back home and they have to travel to make a living. And then you have guest workers, people who are in the country under special H-2A agriculture visas. And then you also have a group of undocumented workers who may find work in Illinois in neighboring states. So
yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Mm-hmm.
These licensed migrant labor camps are for these groups of workers. In Illinois, they're specifically for 10 or more workers or 4 or more families. Any building that meets that definition has to be licensed by the Illinois Department of Public Health.
And they're licensed by the Illinois Department of Public Health. Who owns the facilities?
Various farmers, camp operators, or agribusiness companies. When we're looking at that Rantoul facility specifically, it's owned and operated by a company called Unique Storage.
Let's talk about that specific facility. That's the Nightingale Migrant Facility. What was it like when you, I know as part of your reporting, obviously you were there. Can you describe to us the conditions that you saw?
Well, it's kind of odd being there because it's this unique structure that is on a former Air Force base and it's a former hospital. So if you can imagine walking through a hospital that's still in action, it's kind of like that. You could still see some nurses' stations, concrete walls, concrete floors, furnished, pretty sparsely with tables, chairs, things like that, a larger communal kitchen. And then when you're looking at the conditions of that facility, state inspection records, will show that in some years they lacked operable smoke detectors, fire extinguishers, important, fire safety requirements. If you look in the kitchen, some of the stoves were rusting. They were missing burner knobs. Inside the bedrooms, some of the mattresses were soiled. And these aren't severe. This the most severe problems we've seen in Illinois, but they are pretty typical for a lot of the camps that you come across. And currently, I believe there are just over a dozen or so camps in Illinois. Actually, I think exactly 14.
Robert, as you said, you've also not just visited this, but you and the other folks at the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting have gone through hundreds of inspection reports. So there is actually a system in Illinois for inspecting and keeping and ensuring that I imagine that conditions are sanitary and clean, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's correct. And that system in Illinois is, as I mentioned, any camp, any facility that houses 10 or more workers or 4 or more families has to apply for a license or a permit to house those workers. And then inspectors from the Illinois Department of Public Health will examine that housing before workers move in and at least once while workers are actually in there. And under the Illinois Migrant Labor Camp Law, which was amended in 2014, the health department does have the authority to enforce rules and develop different rules to make sure those conditions are, safe and suitable for people to live in.
What did your reporting find about whether or not those rules are being enforced? Are they?
Well, yeah, and to answer that, it's a complicated question. So, yes, inspectors are going in, and they are, detailing what they're finding. But at the same time, it's questionable if things are actually improving or if things are actually changing. The health department, they do say that a lot of the problems are quickly addressed. Some might even be fixed on site. Others maybe soon after. But when you're really digging down and looking at inspection reports year after year, you notice some of the same exact problems popping up. And we did ask the health department if fines have ever been issued, and that's never been the case. The Illinois Department of Public Health has never really find a facility for violations year after year.
Robert, what do the people who are living in these facilities say about the conditions? What do they think about it?
Well, that's a complicated question, too, because a lot of these people are hesitant to really speak out if something is wrong. You have to keep in mind that they need this job. And so if they criticize their employer or the people housing them, they might come back next year and find out they don't have a job. At the same time, a lot of the people do just feel fortunate to have a job, to have some place to stay. One of the workers that I spoke to at Rantoul, you know, he simply said that, "I'm happy to be here. You know, I've been in worse places."
That's Robert Hawley. He's a reporter with the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, an ongoing investigation they've been doing into migrant worker facilities throughout the state. That's specifically about one in Rantoul. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We will have all the information about Robert's reporting on our website if you head to 21stshow.org. You can also always find out what we're working on if you look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21stshow. That does it for our show today. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.